From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week are Charles Solomon, Angie Hahn, and Wade Major. We'll hear their opinions of director Ron Howard's Hillbilly Elegy, starring Amy Adams, Glenn Close, and Dylan Gage. The Climb tells the story of friendship between characters portrayed by Michelangelo Covino and Kyle Marvin. The stars co-wrote the movie and Covino directed it. And our John Horn interviews Covino while on a bike ride. That's later this hour. The horror comedy Freaky stars Vince Vaughn and Catherine Newton as a serial killer and high school student who swap bodies. Also this week, the wonderful Irish Animation House Cartoon Saloon's new movie, Wolf Walkers. It's Film Week right after NPR News on KPCC. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, the KPCC app, and on podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm joined this week by film critics Wade Major of Cinegods.com, Angie Hahn, Deputy Entertainment Editor at Mashable, and Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Ron Howard's direction of the adaptation of Hillbilly Elegy, a best-selling book from J.D. Vance. Vanessa Taylor did the adaptation of the book, Howard directed, and Hillbilly Elegy stars Amy Adams, Glenn Close, and Dylan Gage. Wade, what did you think of it?
I'm going to nod to John Powers, our colleague and a former Film Week critic,
yes,
who once called Green Book the best film of 1965. I'm going to call Hillbilly Elegy the best film of 1985. It feels like a movie out of time. Even though it is a period film, it feels like one of those mid-80s movies that were just littered with stars, that were done so with such polish and such panache, and even if they were trying to give it a feel of grit, they were trying so hard to make it look gritty that it was polished gritty. And this has that feel. And I don't know that it serves the material particularly well. It feels like a kind of stylistic throwback to the kinds of films that Ron Howard used to make. And I was just too aware of the filmmaking and of the construction in it.
It's based on a true story, a late Yale law student who goes back to his hometown in the Appalachian Mountains. Angie, what'd you think of Hillbilly Elegy?
Yeah, I remember. I know it's based on this book that came out in 2016 that at the time was very much held up as like, oh, this is the book that's going to explain Trump voters by explaining the culture of the white working class. But the Ron Howard movie takes out a lot of there's not that much sociopolitical commentary in it. And it kind of turns out that when you remove that, it just becomes a story about a guy who becomes a lawyer. I was left being like, what is the point of this? It's really boring. It doesn't have interesting characters because the characters are only defined by their trauma and the things that went wrong in their lives and not by anything about who they are or what they want or what they're interested in. I couldn't name a single personality trait that the protagonist has. It's supposed to be steeped in this culture of Appalachia, but it's not really clear at all what makes this region or town or neighborhood different from anywhere else, so it doesn't have a strong sense of place. And Amy Adams and Glenn Close give these very Oscar-baity performances, by which I mean de-glamorized with lots of screaming and drama, but they feel like highlights reels. They don't feel like fully fleshed characters.
And did you feel, Angie, like the personal nature of this story at all, or did it not convey that? Did you at all feel like you were Vance going back and encountering his past?
Not really, because as I said, I literally could not name you a single personality trait that guy has. He's just a kind of black hole. And this is not the fault of the actors. It seems like it's just the way that he was written, where the only thing the movie is interested in is this tumultuous upbringing that he had and not anything about, like, what's he like? What is he interested in? Like, any of the, like, what are his passions in life or anything like that? So even despite it being this uplifting story about this guy's personal family history, it felt weirdly generic.
Yeah. Wade, you felt similarly?
I do. It's very, very hard. You know, when you're telling a story that has to be immersed in a particular time and place, and this goes back and forth between his teenage years and his adult years. So you're constantly sort of being immersed in his memories, the trauma that, you know, he had to overcome to get to law school, and, you know, the baggage that he's carrying with him through every single phase of his life. But it's not unusual baggage. You know, if you've been on this earth for longer than 15 or 20 years, you've probably seen at least 10, 15, 20 movies about people who have to overcome hardship. Many of them are World War II movies or refugee films or films about people who come from an immigrant background. There are all kinds of hardships in the world. And a substantial number of the movies that are made every year are about hardship. So you have to give it something else. You have to give me another reason other than these people have a screwed up life and they have hurdles to overcome. There has to be something that sets them apart. And the way that this has been put together, the only thing that sets them apart is that they'd all like to win Oscars for their performances.
Hillbilly Elegy from director Ron Howard, screenwriter Vanessa Taylor, starring Amy Adams, Glenn Close, and Dylan Gage. It's rated R. It's streaming on Netflix beginning November 24th. Right now, you can see it in Simi Valley at the Studio Movie Grill and select Orange County theaters. The Climb stars Michelangelo Covino, who also directed the film and co-wrote it with his co-star Kyle Marvin. The film is in multiple drive-in locations and Orange County theaters. Angie, what'd you think of The Climb?
This one, I'm happy to say that I enjoyed a lot. It's a romance story, which is one that we've kind of seen before, but this one digs deeper, is a little bit richer, and really thrives off the real-life chemistry between its leads, who I believe wrote the film together. It's often very funny, but it's also quite sad. It's grounded, but with these tiny little touches of almost surrealism in these, I guess you would call them musical numbers that break up the chapters of the story. And it's got this distinct style and structure in that it's told in about 7 vignettes over about 10 years. And each of those vignettes tends to be just a couple of really long takes. I had a great time. I found it to be really touching and it just a interesting look at this friendship that is genuinely loving, but also toxic, constantly under threat, but also the most consistent thing in either of these men's lives. It's not played as a joke, but it's not played as a celebration. It's just an acknowledgement of the messiness of human relationships.
We're talking about the dramatic comedy, The Climb. Wade, what do you think?
Yeah, I largely agree. I think I have a few little quibbles with it. I mean, it's from the 80s to the 90s. Now, this is very much a kind of independent film that we used to get a lot of in the early 90s. And you can tell that Covino and Marvin, who co-wrote it and star in it, that this is a shtick that they have done for many, many years. They have their relationship and all the riffs and the timing down to a fine art. And they just decided to put it on film. It is very artfully directed by Covino, who really doesn't make any secret of the fact that he's nodding to French film, and especially the French New Wave. There are some very, very long, artful takes here where the camera just kind of roams through the rooms and roams between characters. It's very well staged and very, very well put together. It's just a tiny bit pretentious. But that's a kind of okay given its pedigree. And ultimately, this is a movie about trust. This is about trust between friends, trust in marriage, trust in the world, trust in yourself. It's about how difficult trust is to come by in all of these things, and how through all of this, somehow these two guys somehow find a way to keep trust alive, despite the fact that it gets beaten down at every single step of the way.
Angie, sometimes with male friendship films like The Climb, the women end up not being fully realized characters. And I'm curious about Gail Rankin's performance here. And do you get a sense of other people being real human beings beyond the two leads?
I think Gail Rankin is probably the most prominent character that is not one of the two men in this friendship. And at first I was a little bit concerned about it. They do set her up to be kind of this woman driving a wedge between them, who is maybe not that great for the one that she is dating. But I do think that as it goes on, you get a better understanding of who she is and how she's invested. She's definitely a supporting character, but I do think that the movie does her the courtesy of treating her like a real person with real concerns and not just an obstacle for these two men and their friendship.
We should mention that KPCC's John Horn actually conducted an interview with Michelangelo Covino, who's the director, star, and co-screenwriter, while they did a bike ride up into the Angeles National Forest. And you're going to hear that later this hour. It's going to be very fun, John's conversation with Covino coming up. We're talking about The Climb, which is rated R. The film's available in select theaters throughout Southern California. Ammonite, a drama from the UK starring Kate Winslet, Saoirse Ronan, and Fiona Shaw. Francis Lee is the writer-director. Charles.
Well, as an amateur paleontologist, when I go to London, I regularly make a pilgrimage to the British Museum to see the fossils that Mary Anning collected, because she was one of the pioneer paleontologists and a great scientist in her own right. But in this film, I kept thinking of the line near the end of Cold Comfort Farm where somebody looks over and says, "I take her with me, but she's so dreary." And they turned this brilliant pioneering scientist into this grim, humorless, introverted drudge who never looks up from anything. I mean, this was a woman who corresponded and knew the major scientists of her day, who had royalty patronizing her shops. And then suddenly her life is turned around when she's left in charge of an amateur scientist's wife, Mrs. Murchison, who really existed. And they have this firefly affair where they mate like crazed weasels, much more explicitly than I would expect in an R-rated movie. And then she goes back to being a drudge again.
We're talking about Ammonite. Angie, what did you think?
I found this to be pretty interesting, actually. Not perfect, not quite what you expect. And I can see, and to Charles's point, I can see that it doesn't really work that well if you're expecting a biopic of this person. I also don't think that it entirely works as a romance, which is it's being sold as. There's just too much that doesn't add up, that we don't understand, that's left unstated. And the relationship feels less like a meeting of two souls than just two people who fall for each other because the other person is there and they like each other well enough, so why not? But that's actually the level at which I think it does work. To me, this is less a story about love than about loneliness, and specifically about Mary's loneliness. It becomes this portrait of this woman who's very unhappy and does long for companionship but doesn't know how to open herself up. And Kate Winslet is so great as Mary Anning in that kind of role. She wears that isolation like a coat shielding her from the elements. So, you know, there's maybe a few too many things that, about it that doesn't quite work, but I found it to be really fascinating.
As we're used to with Kate Winslet, who seems it's impossible to give even a mediocre performance. She's so good. Ammonite, Wade.
I'm going to kind of split the difference between Charles and Angie. I'm sitting here laughing at Charles's description because I largely agree with it. But, you know, the thing that we have to remember here is this is probably less about Mary Anning than it is about writer-director Francis Lee, who is a gay English filmmaker who made his debut with a film that was kind of viewed as the UK Brokeback Mountain, God's Own Country. And so his films are very much preoccupied with gay identity, in this case, gay female identity. And that's he's using Mary Anning's life as a vehicle to explore that. Now, whether or not that's fair, we can debate it. There's no evidence whatsoever historically that Mary Anning was gay. That's completely fabricated for the sake of the film. So he's taking some license there. So if you want a biopic about Mary Anning, her accomplishments, her achievements, the struggles, the legitimate struggles in her life, and she was poor almost her entire life. I mean, it's really an extraordinary thing. This is not that film. If you want a film that uses her life as a vehicle to explore the issues that Francis Lee is interested in exploring, well, it may very well be that. But I would say for those issues, Portrait of a Lady on Fire is a much better film, and it tells basically a comparable story.
Ammonite is the drama we're talking about, starring Kate Winslet, Saoirse Ronan, and Fiona Shaw. Francis Lee, the writer-director, it's rated R. It's at the Vineland Drive-In in Los Angeles County and select Orange County theaters. Check your local listings. Also this week, the horror comedy Freaky. Wade, at least get us started on that before we break.
Oh, what a fun movie this is. Christopher Landon, who did Happy Death Day and, you know, co-wrote a lot of the Paranormal Activity sequels, son of Michael Landon, really knocks it out of the park here with a combination Friday the 13th mashup with body swapping movies, and it's a lot of fun.
Freaky is the film. Angie, what'd you think?
I half agree with Wade. I think it's a really fun premise that starts off really strong with some really gory and fun kills, including a wine bottle one that I don't want to spoil, but really just made me jump. And it's fun to watch Catherine Newton and Vince Vaughn play each other, but I think it runs out of steam as it goes on.
Well, and does it have full-out laughs to it, or is it just sort of chuckles?
I laughed hard and I laughed a lot. Now, I don't particularly like horror films, so I naturally gravitate to movies that kind of rib horror films, that riff on them, that sort of take the steam out of them, which I think this does very well. It gets to be the Friday 13th movie and make fun of it all at the same time. Now, watching Vince Vaughn very convincingly impersonate an 18-year-old girl for an hour and a half is really, really fun. And watching Catherine Newton turn into a completely psychotic serial killer for an hour and a half is also really fun. And that's what I think drives it. There's not a single unexploited joke opportunity in this thing. Every possible joke that they could come up with, they really milk it to the hilt. And that's why I enjoyed it.
So briefly, Angie, which half of it did you like?
I thought that it started out strong and then it ran out of steam. And then toward the end, it reaches for this female empowerment message that kind of seems like we went through so much trouble for something that's not that interesting, and ultimately reinforces some of the very ideas that it's trying to subvert, which I don't want to say too much more because, you know, spoilers.
All right, sounds good. Freaky is the horror comedy we're talking about. Christopher Landon directing and co-wrote it with Michael Kennedy. Vince Vaughn, Catherine Newton, and Celeste O'Connor starts rated R and in select Orange County theaters. Freaky is the film. Coming up, we'll hear about the Netflix streaming fantasy Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey movie, right here on Film Week. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, streaming on kpcc.org, and maybe even out of your smart speaker if you told it to play KPCC. So good to have you with us. My pleasure to be joined by our film critics this week, Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Angie Hahn. Next up is the fantasy film Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey movie. It stars Anika Noni Rose and Forrest Whitaker, along with Keegan-Michael Key. It's written and directed by David E. Taubert. Angie, what'd you think of Jingle Jangle?
Oh, wow. The word for this, I think, is extravagant. It feels overstuffed in every regard, like the filmmaker was told, you have 2 hours, and he decided, I'm going to cram as much plot and characters and ideas and musical themes and visual details into those 2 hours as possible. And it's a little bit overwhelming at first. It took me a while to even really understand what the basic plot was going to be. But then around halfway through, Keegan-Michael Key, who plays the villain, has this musical number, and I was like, I think I'm having a great time. And by the end, I was just completely won over. I mean, it's the story's nonsense. There's a lot of very weird stuff happening here, but there's enough goodwill and holiday cheer with a strong enough emotional core that I was able to forgive its flaws. It's kind of like an overeager puppy in that it's just doing too much, but that's almost what's endearing about it.
Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey movie. Wade.
Yeah, it's my one word for this is bonkers. David E. Taubert has been doing black theater much longer than Tyler Perry. And he's always been kind of there alongside Tyler Perry. They moved into, you know, television movies about the same time. And he was always, for some reason, at least with movies kind of, and TV, kind of in Tyler Perry's shadow. This is going to change that. He's a much better director than Tyler Perry, an enormously better director. I don't know that he's a better writer, though, at least in this context. This film, it makes no sense. It's all over the map. You know, it doesn't matter that we're sort of in Victorian England, and at least half, if not most of the cast is black, and some people have British accents and some don't. It doesn't really depict a real world. It kind of depicts a world that he's invented for the purpose of this story and this particular Christmas fantasy. But the only reason you stick with it is because it's beautifully shot. The musical numbers are a lot of fun. It's got some individual scenes that are a lot of fun. Forrest Whitaker is really good. But apart from that, nothing here makes any sense.
Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey movie. Charles.
Well, I come in closer to Wade. I found it bewildering that although you have dialogue, songs, and voiceover narration, you still can't follow the story. We're told again and again that Forrest Whitaker's character is the greatest inventor who ever lived. But it's not one of his inventions that brings itself to life. It's some magical elixir that arrives out of nowhere, unexpected. And in 1986, the great mouse detective introduced CG gears and clockwork to American audiences. I think it's time we gave it a rest. There are so many gears and so many watch movement pieces in this thing. I was just gritting my teeth, so I'm afraid it didn't do much for me.
All right, I do have to go back to Angie, though, because it really won you over, Angie. I want you to finish on this and what impression it left you with.
it left me with that feeling of holiday cheer. And I don't know, maybe I was just in a, you know, emotionally in the mood for something kind of heartwarming, but it ends up being a story about this family. Forrest Whitaker is this grandfather who is estranged from his daughter, and then his life is changed when his very plucky granddaughter re-enters his life. And it's just kind of touching to watch all these people come together. There's also some weird stuff where it's ostensibly a STEM movie because they do a lot of math, but the math is actually magic. It's very, very strange. So I agree with all that. But I have a soft spot in my heart for movies that are strange but mean really well.
Well, and I wanted to end it with you because I wanted to hear the positive at the very end. Jingle Jangle, A Christmas Journey movie. It's streaming on Netflix. It stars Anika Noni Rose, Forrest Whitaker, and Keegan-Michael Key. David E. Talbert is the writer-director. It's rated PG. Wolfwalkers is an animated film from the wonderful Secret of Kells and so many other terrific animated filmmakers. Tom Moore, Ross Stewart are the directors. Charles, please start us off. And I know you have a very personal connection to this film because of the book you did about it.
Yeah, so when Abrams asked me to write about the work of Cartoon Saloon, I was delighted because I've admired and respected their work since Secret of Kells, which is about 10 years ago now. This is their most polished and I think in some ways sophisticated film to date. It deals with shapeshifters in Ireland at the time of Cromwell's brutal repression of the Irish people. And you have an English girl who comes with her hunter father to Ireland, and she befriends a girl who belongs to a mysterious tribe of shapeshifters. And unlike a lot of the aggressively plucky, aggressively girl power heroines in American animated films, Robin is complex. She has doubts. She has fears. She grows as a character. And also, this is a film that revels in being drawn. The city, which Cromwell dominates, is done in a rectilinear style with slightly friable lines that look like woodblock prints, whereas the forest is this great series of curves, almost Art Nouveau in feel, that are wild and unchecked. And they extend that even to the effects. The fire in the city burns in an angular way, and the water flows in angles, whereas in the forest, it's natural and it's beautiful. And it is a lovely film that I enjoyed and enjoyed writing about.
And Charles's book is The Art of Wolfwalkers, a behind-the-scenes art book of the film. I wanted him to review it, even though he has this personal connection with the movie. These filmmakers just do such tremendous work. Wade, what did you think of Wolfwalkers?
Well, I have a personal connection with Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell's son married a woman by the name of Dorothy Major, whose father, my direct ancestor, was banished from England for objecting to the marriage.
Wow.
So Oliver Cromwell holds a rather treasured place in our history. And so watching him depicted in this movie, you know, you connect to all of that. And I love this film. I genuinely love this film. It shares a lot of common DNA, obviously, with Brave. In that it's this young girl empowerment story that's very much rooted in kind of Gaelic mythology, but it's a much better script than Brave. It's a very intelligent story. It's built in a very, very complicated way, and yet a way that's accessible to kids. And you almost don't even realize how kind of almost subversively clever it is, the way that it plants its seeds and the way that it kind of nourishes its narrative threads. You don't see where it's going to go necessarily. It takes a number of unexpected twists and turns. The voice work is wonderful. The animation is just absolutely bewitching. I think it's a superb film and really deserves to win an Oscar.
Wolfwalkers, the animated film. Angie.
Well, I feel left out because I do not have a personal connection to this film, but I concur with Charles and Wade. I also really liked it. I mean, as Charles kind of touched upon already, the animation is just so beautiful, this pencil and watercolor look that gives it this handcrafted, timeless feel, but also feels very unique and fresh, especially compared to a lot of the major studio offerings in terms of animation. It'd be worth watching even if it were just for its beauty, just to take in the visuals. But the story is also really interesting. I love that the kids felt like real kids and not like movie kids. And I also like that because it kind of connects with the children on their level, it is able to use their unique perspective into the story that it's telling, which is about a lot of things, including the fear and the fallibility of the adult around them. That becomes a way to talk about colonialism and environmentalism from a kind of interesting point of view. And without being too precious about it, it presents Robin and Maeve as being able to see the world with fresh eyes and see things that the adults have taken for granted. So it's a movie that I think really works with kids on their own level, but that adults will find a lot to appreciate in it as well.
And Angie, I just love the films the Cartoon Saloon does, like Song of the Sea, The Breadwinner. I mean, the films are beautiful, but there's something really rich about the storytelling in all of their films.
Yeah, totally. And I think that the visuals also just, Charles talked about this already a bit, so I won't go too much into it, but the visuals also just really, really work for the story that it's telling, the themes that it's trying to explore.
All right. The film, again, is Wolfwalkers, animated film that's in select theaters in Orange County. It'll be on Apple TV Plus beginning in the middle of December. Wolfwalkers is rated PG. Dreamland, a drama that stars Finn Cole, Margot Robbie, and Travis Fimmel. It's directed by Miles Joris Perafee. What do you think of it, Wade?
You know, it starts really strongly. It's beautifully shot, but it ultimately doesn't really go anywhere. And that's the really unfortunate thing here. This is a Dust Bowl, Depression-era movie about a young man who's coming from a broken family, trying, you know, his father left the family many years earlier and went down to the Gulf Coast. And he yearns for, you know, he looks at that postcard that he got once when he was a child from his dad. And that's sort of the other world. That's the other side of the rainbow for him, from all of this poverty and desolation that he's growing up with. And then into his world comes Margot Robbie, who is this gun moll, kind of a, you know, the other half of a Bonnie and Clyde pair who got on the wrong end of the law when they were escaping from a bank robbery. Her partner was killed. She's wounded, and he rescues her. And now it's a question of, do you, you know, turn her into the police, or is this your avenue to adventure and escape from your horrible, horrible circumstances? That's the most interesting part of the film. From there, it makes a lot of very poor narrative choices. It doesn't become a Bonnie and Clyde. It doesn't become a Dust Bowl movie. It doesn't really comment in any significant way on what was happening in Bismarck, North Dakota at the time. It just sort of lies there and lets the movie dwindle to an end, and it's really unfortunate.
Dreamland is the film starring Finn Cole and Margot Robbie. Miles Joris Perafee is the director and Nicholas Wart the screenwriter. It's rated R, available on demand platforms. You're listening to Film Week on KPCC. Back with more reviews from our critics in a moment. So good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Angie Hahn, Charles Solomon, and Wade Major. Our next movie this week, a British drama, Monsoon, starring Henry Golding, Parker Sawyers, and Molly Harris. Hong Kao is the writer and director of the film. Angie, what'd you think of Monsoon?
I found it to be a really graceful and poignant take on the immigrant experience, as well as an unusual, at least for the West, take on the Vietnam War and the lingering legacy of it. So this is a movie about a gay British man returning to Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, 30 years after his family fled when he was a child after the Vietnam War. And what I like about this movie is that it really takes its time. It's not long, it's less than 90 minutes, but it reveals itself to you gradually, like a flower kind of opening up. You can sense that there's some pain there, you can sense that there might be some sweetness, but the specific forms that those take only gradually come into focus. And in order to make that work, you need a really subtle, strong actor to anchor that. And Henry Golding really does, which it's not that I ever doubted his talents, but he's someone that became famous playing much flashier roles, much more overtly charismatic roles in films like Crazy Rich Asians and Last Christmas. And here he's really scaled back, but he's really, really effective. It makes you wonder what other tricks he's got up his sleeve, and makes me really excited to see what else he can do.
Monsoon, the film. Wade, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. It's really a gorgeous movie. Hong Kao, who wrote and directed it, this is, you know, our second film about gay identity from a gay British filmmaker, so it's theme of the week. But Hong Kao is also ethnically Chinese, born in Cambodia. So he brings an amazing cultural richness to his global experience as well. And he fuels this film with all of that. The depiction of Vietnam is beautiful, yet at the same time, a little bit painful. The performances, it's much less about plot than it is about character and exploration and relationships and memory. And Henry Golding is able to channel all of that richness, oftentimes in a very nonverbal way, that makes this enormously cinematic. It's slow, yet it's never boring. It's deliberate, yet it feels spontaneous. It's a wonderfully crafted film. And I look forward to everything that Henry Golding does in the future and everything that Hong Kao does in the future.
Monsoon, the film is unrated. You can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema, also available on on-demand platforms Vudu, Amazon Prime Video, and Google Play. Fat Man, a Santa Claus action comedy, stars Mel Gibson, Walton Goggins, and Marianne Jean-Baptiste. The film's written and directed by Esham Nelms and Ian Nelms, who are siblings. Wade, what'd you think of Fat Man?
The Joker of Santa Claus movies. Not bad Santa, but badass Santa. So those are my pull quotes for anyone who's looking for them. I've watched this movie twice. The first time because it scared the daylights out of me. I was expecting something really, really funny, and it wound up being very dark and disturbing, and you kind of feel guilty when you laugh. The second time, I laughed a lot because I'd kind of gotten all of the inhibitions out of my system. So basically, this is a very gritty Santa Claus movie in which Santa Claus, played by Mel Gibson of all people, is contracted by the U.S. government, and he's getting his pay cut. And to kind of offset it, they are now going to have him manufacture some kind of military industrial machinery. Meanwhile, this really grouchy, spoiled rich kid, played by Chance Hirschfeld, is upset that he got a lump of coal from Santa Claus, so he hires his right-hand hitman, played by Walton Goggins, to kill Santa Claus. So now and eventually it just becomes a spaghetti Western, and the music gives that away. And if you can imagine what a Santa Claus movie might have been if it were like a Don Siegel, Sergio Leone mashup with Clint Eastwood playing Santa Claus in 1972, this is that movie. It's completely insane. It's very violent, but it ultimately has a Christmas heart to it, but it's a really dark Christmas heart. So if that's your cup of tea this season, boy, you're gonna get a dose of it with Fat Man.
It's rated R. Sounds like highly appropriately, as Wade describes it. Fat Man, written and directed by the siblings Esham and Ian Nelms. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In, at the Regency Westminster, and on-demand platforms Fandango Now, Amazon Prime Video, and iTunes, available on the on-demand platforms starting longer than that, November 24th. So it'll be almost 2 weeks before that is on those on-demand platforms. The documentary I Am Greta follows climate activist Greta Thunberg. The film's directed by Nathan Grossman. Angie?
I found this one to be likable, but not incredible. It may be because Greta Thunberg is such a public figure already, who's just so open about what she stands for and what she's doing. The documentary doesn't really have that much to add about her that we don't already know, but it is interesting to stop and consider her from this more personal perspective. The director started filming her in August 2018, which is when she first started to attract attention for a one-person school strike, and then he follows her over the course of about a year, which turns out to be the year where she just went from some random girl to being one of the most famous climate activists and one of the most famous members of Gen Z in the entire world. So just being able to follow her on that dizzying ascent is kind of interesting, and you get a sense of intimacy that you don't always get when you're seeing just headlines about her. You get to see her as just a teenage girl in these unguarded moments, hanging out with her family or playing with her dogs or stuff like that. And then it becomes kind of interesting as you see that what starts as a straightforwardly uplifting, inspirational journey about this brave young activist becomes much more bittersweet as she starts to realize the limits of her own powers and the limits of what other people are really going to do. So, you know, it's not telling us anything that we probably don't already know, especially if you're someone who follows news about her. But there is value in being reminded that there's a human underneath all those breathless headlines.
I Am Greta, the documentary from director Nathan Grossman. Wade.
Ultimately, a very troubling film to me, and not for reasons that I think people would normally necessarily think. I think if you want a film about climate change, the better movie is Kiss the Ground, which is on Netflix and which we talked about on Film Week some weeks ago. And if you want a better film about what celebrity does to a young activist, the better film is On Her Shoulders, about the Yazidi activist Nadia Murad, which we also talked about on Film Week. This can't quite split the difference. It's not about celebrity. It's not about climate change. It wants to be a celebration of Greta. And so it kind of misses the opportunity to go into other areas that are suggested by her circumstances, notably the fact that she, at least by her own claim, suffers from Asperger's. Clearly, she has something. She's on the spectrum somewhere. And the fact that her parents seem to tolerate and enable all of this, especially the global celebrity. And at the end, I was very troublingly left with the feeling that she is, in some sense, being exploited and abused for the sake of celebrity. And it was not a good feeling. And she herself, when she cries out and says, perhaps we see things differently, those of us with Asperger's, and I obsess with things. When I get my obsession into a thing, I can't let it go. That doesn't necessarily strike me as a good thing. It strikes me as a cry for help. And I don't see anyone in this film who is rushing to help her and put her ahead of the cause. And that's what I was hoping for. And it left me feeling pretty desolate.
Well, and you used the term suffering with Asperger's, and you know, the people that I know that are on the spectrum, I don't necessarily think of them as suffering. It's just being an attribute. And it sounds like she has real pain.
I say that, yes, because she has pain in the film. There's a lot of it. The film starts and she is crying and she is suffering and she's depressed and no one is coming to her help. And I have a great many friends, too, who have children that are on the spectrum. And I know what those families go through, how they make adjustments and the way that they change the nature of family. And I don't see anyone in this film doing that. I don't see her parents doing that. I don't see her friends doing that. I don't see the media doing that.
Wade Major,
and as a result, she is suffering.
Wade Major talking about I Am Greta. I'm sorry, you were just cutting out there for a moment, Wade. Charles Solomon, what do you think of the documentary?
Well, I agree with Wade and with Angie. I think the subject is more interesting than the film. In some sense, it's heartening to see this young woman who's, you know, like a Nobel Prize contender, calling attention and rallying young people to do something about a desperate problem. But then it's depressing to see Vladimir Putin dismiss her and Donald Trump make fun of her. And in the meantime, the planet is continuing to degrade. But the film doesn't really tell us anything, I think, that we didn't already know about her and her cause. So it's well-intended, but doesn't go much of anywhere.
I Am Greta, the documentary on Greta Thunberg. The film is directed by Nathan Grossman. It's streaming on Hulu and unrated. The documentary Queen of Hearts, Audrey Flack, looks at the life of abstract and photorealist artist Audrey Flack. Deborah Schaefer and Rachel Reichman are the directors. Charles?
This was a really interesting film and my surprise of the week. Audrey Flack was one of the very few women who were involved first in abstract expressionism and then in the photorealistic movement. And when she's talking about how her work in those two wildly different styles relates, she's fascinating. And she's similarly compelling when you see her lecturing students about the importance of life drawing and how that understanding of anatomy and the human body underlies all good drawing and all good painting. Absolutely fascinating. Her canvases are very, very striking. The weakness of the film, I would say, is it cuts away from her to give us things like a shot of New York, Chelsea, or to just deal with more mundane matters. I'm less interested in some of the details of her life than in just seeing her work and hearing her talk about it. And that part of it is fascinating. And people who are looking for, you know, this kind of insight and interest into a really talented artist's work, this film's a revelation.
Queen of Hearts, Audrey Flack, the documentary on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. It's unrated. Coming up, our John Horn interviews the director and star of this week's film, The Climb. It's Film Week on KPECC. Great to have you with us. We all know the coronavirus has turned filmmakers' worlds upside down. The feature film The Climb experienced several release delays stretching through most of last year, something others in the industry are grappling with as well. KPECC's John Horn spoke with director Michael Covino and producer Kyle Marvin, who co-wrote the screenplay and starred in the film. In fact, John spoke with them twice, first in September a year ago when The Climb was playing film festivals and hadn't yet come out in theaters, then again this March when its release was postponed because of the pandemic. John's with me now. John, tell us what happened.
Well, it's like a lot of movies. They thought they were going to come out and then they didn't. And this has been a really interesting story because this is a movie that started as a short film that premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in 2018. It was turned into a feature that premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in May of 2019. It was supposed to come out in March of this year, March 20th. Then they moved it to July 17th. Then they moved it to October 9th. And then finally, they moved it to November 13th. Only in a limited number of theaters because very few theaters are open. So it is coming out, but not in the way I know the filmmakers first imagined.
Well, it got good reviews, right? Looked like it had a promising future, and the two filmmakers also getting that positive feedback on the movie.
Yeah, it was going to be, and it still could be, their big break. I mean, these are two filmmakers who have worked in the business for a while, and they have some credits, but nothing as important or as material as The Climb. And yes, I think it's over 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, if you think that's a good score. But critics liked the short. They loved the feature. I mean, it played at Cannes. It played at Telluride. It played at Toronto. It played at all the big film festivals. This was going to be their big break, and it's still sitting on a shelf until this weekend.
We're talking with KPECC's John Horn. A bike ride is at the center of the film. It started as a short that played at Sundance in 2018 for being turned into a feature. And you actually conducted this interview for The Climb while on a bike ride?
That was the idea, and I think we did it. It's really about these two guys who, in fact, are best friends, but these are fictionalized versions of their true selves. They're on a bike ride. Mike, who is the director of the film, Mike Covino, tells Kyle that Mike is having an affair with Kyle's fiance. That's in the short. That's in the feature. And it's while they're on a very hard bike ride. And I thought it'd be good to interview them on a very hard bike ride, but I made it a lot harder because I forgot to put the battery in my electronic shifter.
Oh, no.
And for those people who know how important that is, you literally cannot shift your bike. And we were going up Glendora Mountain Road into the Angeles National Forest, and it's about 6%. It's basically straight up. And it's very hard if you're not in a small gear, and I was not in a small gear.
Is this the most unusual interview locale you've had, John?
I will say it's the most painful. I mean, I was literally dying, and I'm a pretty good bike rider. I mean, these guys are very good bike riders. And the way I would do the interview is I'd take a couple of turns on the pedals, collect my breath, and then ask a question. And while they were talking, try to catch up with them. It was unusual, but I hope it was a good conversation.
All right. John Horn interviewing The Climb's Michael Covino and Kyle Marvin as together they try to climb up Glendora Mountain Road.
Am I rolling? Everybody else is? What was the last interview you did on bikes? Is this the first?
Yeah, this is definitely the first.
Let's talk about the short film, which was shot, what, 20, 30 miles west of here, right?
Yeah, up by like Lakeview Terrace.
Okay.
Little Tahunga.
So how did that come together? What were the first conversations you guys had about making a movie?
Well, I think it came together at first. I was on the long bike ride with my thoughts, and you know, there's a lot of solitude and you kind of get inside your head sometimes when you're doing that. And I was thinking about an experience I had where one of my friends slept with an ex-girlfriend, and Kyle and I had been looking for an idea for a short to do together, and it just sort of sparked. And the idea was pretty simple. It was just, what if someone revealed to their best friend that they slept with their ex on a bike ride, but the other guy was so out of shape that he couldn't catch him and he started chasing him up the hill.
How did you write it? I mean, it feels super conversational, but How much is scripted? How much is laid out?
It was all scripted. What we actually did was every day for lunch, we would ride bikes and rehearse it.
Right.
And sometimes we'd record the rehearsals. And through that, which it was almost like when you're working on a play, you find different words and different beats and you sort of trim out the fat and get to the really the heart of what is working with it. That, you know, over 3 weeks, we sort of rehearsed it like a play and then got to a place where we were like, okay.
And had you imagined it being a longer film? Was it a calling card? How did it end up as a short?
Yeah, I think our goal was to make the best short we could.
Right.
So it was ultimately just going to be a great short. And when we got into Sundance, we realized we had the opportunity to, if we could find something in the short worth making a feature, make a feature out of it. And that's really the impetus.
Like we kind of realized by producing, you know, feature films over the last 5 years, that the second you commit to doing that, you're basically committing to at least a year and a half or 2 years.
Okay, only downhill 10 feet. Now the fun starts.
Just for the
thank God I've got the wrong gear.
We're now hitting the hill.
5% grade. I'm in my big chain ring.
If John's out of breath for most of this, it's because he's out of the saddle.
So the short screens in Park City, what, 2018? And how quick do people say to you, what else you got?
Well, we pitched the feature at Sundance. So we went to Sundance knowing that there might be some interest. So we put together the full pitch for the feature there. And then out of Sundance, we found our partners and then we pretty much started writing immediately and, you know, turned in the first draft of the script, I think May, like right before Cannes.
Yeah.
So a year ago before it shows. So it's relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And what was the core idea that you had for turning into a feature?
I think what we really tapped into is a tone. There's like a tone to the short that we really resonated with. And we were like, all right, if we can capture that tone and carry the story forward to an interesting place, then we have a great movie.
Yeah, like we had clearly defined character dynamics. So like we knew who these characters were to each other. And so the you know, fleshing out the story was like, okay, well, if that's how they are to each other, how can we continue to, you know, to test the boundaries of what that looks like over the next decade or so.
One of the conceits of the short is a single take, which for a short is one thing, for a feature is another. Why was that important to preserve?
You know, I think we set out to say we love the aesthetic of a single take because there's an immediacy to it.
Car back. Oh, you okay?
Yep. To answer that question, I think it's like, when you don't cut, There's like a real-time nature to it that we loved and that we found in the short was like, wow, why don't we want to look away? It's because we haven't cut and we're just living with these characters as they're struggling on these bikes.
Like, and I'm struggling today.
Yeah, like right now. And so I think the idea was, you know, we tested the boundaries of when we were doing the feature. We said, all right, we can always cut if we ever feel like we're forcing it. But by putting those limitations at the outset, we ended up discovering just a visual language for the film that we probably wouldn't have otherwise, that in our mind, we thought really served the story.
What surprised you about the reaction to the short? What, outside of people wanting to know what else you got, what was gratifying about its reception?
Well, the fact that it got into Sundance was just crazy, because we definitely didn't expect that. I think it was just one of these things we did on the side amidst everything else we were working on that we were like, oh, this is fun, let's just do it. And then really thought nothing of it. And then to have it get into that festival, which we've been trying to get films into for the last 10 years and have struck out every time, to have it be like this little thing we're doing on the side was a little crazy. You know, and then getting to the festival and hearing people sort of come up to us and talk to us about like their friendships and I don't know, just them getting something from it that maybe we saw but weren't sure if people would get.
Part of the story is about what you do when you get knocked down and how you get back up. Is that something you guys thought about in terms of your own filmmaking careers? Rejection, things not coming together?
Yeah, I think we've had long conversations about, you know, over the years about like, it has to happen at some point.
Right.
It's sort of a, you know, it's just a numbers game, and you know, if you keep working at it, you get better and better. And so, I don't know. I mean, maybe it stems from, you know, Kyle's dad's a mountaineer, and I played football for 16 years, which like instilled me with this maybe delusional sense of, if you work at it, it'll happen.
Right.
So you know, we were content with being in our mid to late 40s and still trying to get our first film in a Sundance.
KPCC's John Horn talking while riding his bike with the creators of The Climb, director Michael Covino and producer Kyle Marvin, who both wrote the screenplay and starred in the film. It's out now. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in Los Angeles County and the Galaxy Mission Grove Luxury in Riverside. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. From all of us, have a great weekend.